We're going to have our final reading for this morning, which is taken from Daniel chapter 3. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated, and he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men who were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "But I see 4 men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the 4th is like a son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire, and the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted in him, and set aside the king's command, and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree, any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way. And then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. So far, and Jason will bring us the message for this morning.
Well, what we have open in front of us today that Tim just read in Daniel chapter 3 reads to most of us, I think, as a very familiar account, a very lovable account, and for most of us probably an account that we first heard as children. And it'd be very easy to just gloss over it in a sense because it is so familiar and because we have known it for so long. But in actual fact, to my mind, this chapter 3 of Daniel is probably the toughest chapter in this book, if not one of the toughest chapters in the Bible altogether, because here in chapter 3 of Daniel, it's not all straightforward. We actually run smack bang into some brick walls, and I just want to pull out three brick walls today that we hit, each of which calls us to face up to some very tough questions. The first brick wall that we hit is in verse 1, right at the beginning. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon, and we come to a grinding halt in the narrative here because we only just read, if you remember last week, the long account in chapter 2 where Nebuchadnezzar received a revelation from God that really should have put his attitude into quite the more humble perspective than what we just read here in chapter 3. Do you remember last week? After Nebuchadnezzar learned really of the futility of his own kingdom in the scheme of things, and of course the futility of all other earthly kingdoms yet to come, after learning of the eternal kingdom of God and that kingdom would one day fill the whole earth, and even after getting to the point of praising God by the end of chapter 2 for these things, didn't he? He was praising God by the end of chapter 2, and now suddenly he builds himself a statue in his own image and makes all the people in his empire bow down and worship him. So we hit this brick wall, and we've got to ask, how did Nebuchadnezzar go from there in chapter 2 to here in chapter 3? What happened exactly between the end of chapter 2, where Nebuchadnezzar was praising the God of heaven, and the first verse of chapter 3, where he imposes himself as a god over all people? We wonder to ourselves, you know, did the dream in chapter 2 end up going to Nebuchadnezzar's head? How's he taken the interpretation in that dream of that gold head on the statue that he dreamt about in chapter 2 and verse 38 to now making an enormous image of gold of himself in real life? Did he catch anything of what was just revealed to him? Did he understand anything about God at the end of the day on that? And most importantly of all, I think, in the flow of the narrative, where exactly is Nebuchadnezzar in this whole question of God? Because it seemed as though he was almost there at the end of chapter 2. But clearly he's not. He's still out for his own glory as chapter 3 opens up, and he sets up an image of himself and he demands that everyone everywhere must bow down and worship him. And verse 4, so the herald proclaims aloud the order that you are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Now, as I say, what he wants here is for people to worship him. a statue represents him. And so by worshipping the statue, the people are worshipping Nebuchadnezzar. That's what's going on here. And a penalty of this burning fiery furnace is added to the decree, and the king has spoken. Everyone everywhere must worship him. He might have picked up, as Tim was reading that passage, the repetitive nature that captures how all-inclusive this decree is. First of all, three different words get used: peoples, nations, languages. Three different words to make sure that we see that the king is binding this on all citizens throughout his whole empire in verse 4, and it gets repeated in verse 7. And so too, there are eight different ways of making sure all the officials throughout the empire are covered under this decree in verse 2. And again, it gets repeated in verse 3 in case we missed it. In other words, nobody will be above this rule. And then did you notice how many different ways of saying music Tim read out that the king could use in verse 4 and 5 and again repeated for good measure in verse 6, just to rule out any confusion at all. Whenever you hear any kind of sound, you will all obey this rule. There's no wiggle room. There's no wiggle room in this at all. The king has spoken. And whenever the music plays, all people everywhere will obey. Welcome to the new normal, good people of Babylonia. Nebuchadnezzar's journey towards God is so confusing, isn't it, at this point? What he does here at the start of chapter 3 flies in the face of what we read at the end of chapter 2. He just does not make sense, this guy. Surely, with that contrast painted so sharply by Daniel here, we're meant to hit that brick wall and ask questions about it. And I suspect that the impact was actually meant to have us questioning our own journey. It's easy for us to sit here and pull our hair out in frustration over Nebuchadnezzar's confusing journey. But how are we going? How are we going? Are we actually following God and following God wholeheartedly? Do we sing God's praises one day and then turn around and seek our own glory the next? This first brick wall is hard if you manage to hit it in the way I think we're meant to hit it. The bottom line is we need to glorify God with our whole lives. We need to glorify God, not just in word, but in how we then live. And perhaps in a way Nebuchadnezzar is supposed to capture for us the sinful inclination of every human heart, so that we check what our hearts are doing. If we survive that brick wall, I'm afraid the next one's just as hard, and it's just as abrupt, because just like the complete contrast with that statue thing in Nebuchadnezzar, there's also a complete contrast with these three men, Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, these three Jewish characters, in terms of their status in Babylon. The status of these three men at the end of chapter 2, we read in chapter 2, verse 49, that Daniel made a request to the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. That's where Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego were when we left off last week, overseeing the affairs of the Babylonian Empire. Presumably, I guess, above all these satraps and prefects and whatnots in verses 2 and 3 here. But by verse 12, these three Jews have become the enemy of the state because they won't worship the statue of the king. They go from the top to the bottom. And the Chaldeans bring it about, perhaps out of envy, over those high positions these three Jews had been given. And despite the fact that Daniel had actually intervened to save them from execution, if you recall, in chapter 2, the Chaldeans now go after these Jews and they report them to the king over their non-compliance. Verse 13 follows that up. Nebuchadnezzar, when he hears this, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true? Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I've set up?" And then he gives these three men an ultimatum in verse 15. "Now, if you're ready when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music to fall down and worship the image that I've made, Well and good. Well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? It's fascinating that he gives them an ultimatum here instead of just executing them on the spot upon arrest. It's almost as if he wants them to recant and bend. It's as if he has a soft spot for these young men. Or maybe he just wants an answer to his question. Who is the God who can deliver people out of such a crisis as this? We would think Nebuchadnezzar would have a bit of a heads up on that one after chapter 1, where he learnt about the God of the Jews. And again in chapter 2, of course, where he learnt it again. But he will get the clear answer yet again here from Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, who answered to the king and said, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter." That's a stunning response to this all-powerful king, the most powerful man in the known world at that time. "We have no need to answer you in this matter." I say, if these three men weren't getting thrown into the fire before this, I'm pretty sure they are now. But to answer Nebuchadnezzar's theological question, they continue, verse 17, "If this be so, our God whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." So we come to the difficult topic of submitting to authorities. We've got to ask ourselves the question, are they right in what they're saying here? Are these three Jews in the right here to reject the king's demand? Are we not supposed to submit to our authorities? And that's a tough question. And as it happens, the Bible doesn't come to us in the form of a compendium of all of our frequently asked questions, organized into nice, neat little categories for us. So we can't just open up to the chapter on civil obedience and get a neat little answer, a nice little summary of everything we want to know about that. So answering the question here requires a bit more work. And it's the same actually with all of our questions. You see, we tend to come to the Bible with all of our burning questions about life. But the Bible comes to us as a narrative in the main part. Sure, there's other genres in there of lore and poetry and wisdom and so on woven into that story. But the overarching book we have, the framework of it, is a salvation story. It's a grand narrative of how God has set about to bring sinful people to a place of restoration. So to process answering questions like, should these Jews get to the king's demand, requires a bit of thinking. Requires us to think across the scriptures, requires us to consider what the rest of the Bible has to say about that matter. The whole Bible is the word of God for us. And so it all must go together and it must all make sense together because it all comes from the same mind of God. And so we do well to examine more thoroughly what the whole Bible says about this topic or that topic. And for the question at hand, we realize that our text in Daniel 3 is a helpful contribution to the topic of civil obedience, because we know from elsewhere in the Bible that it is good and it is right to submit to those in authority over us. We know that our Lord Jesus modeled submission to the authorities in his life at multiple levels. We know that the Apostle Paul wrote to us about submission in all of our relationships in life. But specifically, we're probably all familiar with Romans 13, where he speaks about submitting to the government, reminding us, as he does, that the government was put in place by our sovereign God. And in our readings this morning, the Apostle Peter said much the same thing, didn't he? Let me read back to you these couple of verses from 1 Peter 2, verse 13 and 14. "Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good." It'd be easy to pick a verse like that and just build our understanding on that. be subject to every human institution. But we do better to look across all of the scriptures and to get a more complete understanding of what the whole Bible says on that topic. And that process, by the way, is called systematic theology, seeing what the whole Bible says and has to say about the kind of questions we have. It's a far better approach than just latching onto one verse and building our understanding on that. The book of Daniel helps us to flesh out this question of being subject to our authorities, because through this incident, we see something different. We learn that being subject to our governing authorities should not extend to us breaking the law of God. And this demand that King Nebuchadnezzar has made would require these three Jews to break God's law. Very blatantly, in fact, they would be breaking the first two commandments, that we must not serve another god and we must not bow down to images of created things. And the king's original decree explicitly contravenes the second commandment, that the men must not worship the king's image. And the first commandment of not serving other gods is then explicitly challenged by the Chaldeans' charges against the men in verse 12, and the king's interrogation of the men in verse 14. And it is explicitly withstood in the men's defense in their response to those charges in verse 18. They must not serve other gods. So with the first two commandments at stake, I think this is one's pretty easy. It's a no-brainer, isn't it? This has got to be the easiest case we could try to answer this question on. And it's certainly the easiest of a few cases of civil disobedience in this book of Daniel that we need to process. We did see another one. In chapter 1, there was a case where the four Jews refused the king's instructions to eat his food and to drink his wine. They didn't want to defile themselves. And I guess what probably looked like it was only in seed form there in chapter 1 has now come to fruition here in chapter 3 in a huge case that's impossible to miss. They resist all the pressure and threats of this powerful king to worship anything or anyone other than their God. Despite Nebuchadnezzar's terrifying threats against them for non-compliance, they must be true to their God and the holiness to which he's called them. So in this case, being in submission to the king, being subject to the king, means going willingly into the fire. So too in our reading from Hebrews 11 that Tim read before, in that hall of faith, the heroes of the faith, it was clear that at times heroes of the faith suffer the consequences instead of submitting to authorities' demands. Some of the heroes of the faith stood their holy ground and suffered horrific consequences for it. So submission does not mean compromising God's law. The problem is we then need to ask the question as to where exactly the line gets drawn. Where is the line that we won't cross? I mean, this in front of us here in Daniel 3 is the easiest case we could ever look at. The first two commandments are at stake. But where do we draw the line before we get to that point? Because as far as I can tell, the Bible doesn't tell us in a nice, neat little paragraph exactly where that line is. Certainly the passages I've just mentioned have got no asterisk saying, obey and submit, except when such and such happens. So we need to do some serious thinking at our end on that score. Where exactly is the line? But chew on that one for a few weeks. We have another example coming up in chapter 6. The third brick wall is perhaps the hardest of all. And this one gets to the heart of our faith itself. We think of the story in front of us of Rack, Shack and Benny, as some of you no doubt know it, as being about the tremendous faith of these three men, how faithful they are. But what they themselves teach us here should actually recalibrate the way we often tend to use that very word, faith. And what do we mean by that word, faith? What is it to have faith in God? We can start by looking at what these men themselves actually say. Verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, Our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O King. Now, modern Christianity would be on board with all of that, I think. The calibration comes in the next verse. But if not, be it known to you, O King, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Do you see what they're saying to the king? Our God is thoroughly capable of delivering us from this fire. But even if he doesn't, in other words, God can, but we don't know if God will, and that doesn't matter. Our Christian culture today needs to hear from these men properly what they're saying here to help us understand what faith looks like. A faith isn't simply trusting that God will deliver us from every trial, prosper us at every turn. Faith is certainly hoping for that. Faith is certainly asking for that all the time. But faith goes much deeper than that. The Bible's idea of faith is more like our idea of faith plus a healthy dose of realism and surrender that's a little bit foreign to us today. God knows what we are going through. He cares what we are going through. But he doesn't spare us from all of life's difficulties. He's not some kind of a good time genie, but rather a sovereign God who promises to work through all things, good and bad things, for our eternal benefit. And he knows what he's doing. These three men are delivered on this occasion, and we all breathe a sigh of relief, and we love the story. But the point of the incident is not to then give us a shallow theology of faith that insists that God will and must always save people from every trial and tribulation in this earthly life. No, the point is simply that we get to see God's power and sovereignty, what he can do, and that is awesome in this story. And so we can answer other questions like, what about all the other people in the Bible who aren't delivered from trouble, like a lot of those heroes of the faith in Hebrews 11. What about the pages of church history where countless numbers of God's people were burned alive? They were burned alive or fed to lions or so on. And they weren't delivered. Did they have less faith than these three men in Babylon? That's the kind of thing we say, isn't it, sometimes? But of course not. Of course they didn't have less faith. That kind of thinking stems from that insufficient and shallow understanding of what faith even is, and thinking that if we just have enough faith, then God must deliver us from our suffering. In actual fact, he quite clearly tells us that as his disciples, we will suffer in this life. Jesus himself said to his disciples in John 16 and verse 33, I have said all these things to you that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation. But take heart, I have overcome the world. So faith is not about being delivered from our earthly troubles. God can do that. We see that so powerfully here in Daniel 3. And we should most certainly ask God to do that at all times. But God will work even suffering and evil for our good in the end. As hard as that is for us to comprehend, it just seems to be part of his wise plan for us. And it's the eternal fire that he has promised to save us from. And that he both can and will do by his word for all who trust his Son, Jesus Christ. In the here and now earthly trials, we need to have the mindset of faith that these three men have in Babylon, that God is able to deliver us from this or that. But even if he doesn't, at which point we come back to the other two brick walls in this chapter, because even if God doesn't deliver us from this or that earthly struggle, we still belong to him. We still follow him and wholeheartedly follow him, and therefore we live obediently to him, unwilling to compromise his commands. And that broader whole of Bible understanding of faith is challenging. It won't let us take a shallow understanding of God's purposes for us, an understanding that's limited to the earthly sphere. It forces us to look upon God's eternal plans for us. It causes us, therefore, to be wary of a kind of blessing theology prominent in our culture today that only really, at the end of the day, speaks to things of this life. Beware, these three guys in Babylon would tell us, I'm sure, if they were here. Beware, the things of this life should never compromise our faith, and nor should any threats or worries associated with them. God has got a much, much bigger plan that he is working towards for our sake. God is able to help our here and now, but he knows and he works what is best for the longer plan. How then can we know, I guess, is the question, how can we know what God will do in this or that earthly situation? Well, we can't. At least I don't think we can. How then do we know that he even can do anything in this situation of life or that? By his track record. By his track record, not just in the testimony of these scriptures and stories like this, accounts like this that we're reading today, not just in identifiable points in history that we can recognize, but in our own personal life, we know that God can save us from things because of his track record, because he has done in the past for people and for us. And so we need to let God build our resilience for tough times. And to do that, we should be seeking him in prayer and asking him for help all the time. All the time. That's exactly what he tells us to do, isn't it, about earthly situations, to put everything to him in prayer, even though we don't know whether he will answer this way or that. As we go through life, putting everything to prayer, to God in prayer, always asking him to help us. By the by, we see situations where clearly he has been at work intervening for us. Sometimes, maybe even usually, it's a retrospective kind of view where we later on see that he was working in our lives, even though we didn't see it at the time. Not in all things, of course. But in enough things, we will slowly learn that, yes, God cares. And, yes, God hears our prayers. And, yes, God can intervene for us in this or that earthly struggle. By putting things to God in prayer all the time, we slowly but surely build up a personal database of God's providential care for us and his power to act for us, knowing that God has demonstrated to us in the past his power and his sovereignties in ways that we have known. That helps us to be resilient in our faith during times of extreme trial. The flip side of that is that we must therefore always be asking God for deliverance in our daily struggles, so that we're always building up a good reference set of data in that personal database, so that we've got substance to draw upon when the fire does hit. If we aren't asking for help from God all the time, then nothing is going to get added to that database. Our confidence in God is never going to grow. God may still intervene for us, of course, and will be intervening for us in ways we can't even see, but we won't register what he's doing. We won't attribute it to him. If anything, we'll fall into just this common delusion of happenstance or luck. That's going to do nothing for us when the fire comes. But a life of slowly collected data where we have routinely asked God to help us, that's going to be the platform from which we can withstand the most serious of trials when they come, like Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego here. And that's why the scriptures are full of psalms and songs and sermons that remember God's mighty work in the past. It's all part of the database, an individual and collective database by which we come to learn that, yes, God can intervene for us if that would be to our eternal benefit. But so too, the data set doesn't hide the fact that God doesn't always answer as we'd hope for. He has got eternal plans for us, bigger than we can see, plans that transcend this earthly struggle. And by this earthly struggle, he's refining us for those eternal plans. So we mustn't fall into the mistake of developing a shallow faith. We've got to develop this deep, resilient kind of faith that these men in Babylon model to us. I wanted to point out those few brick walls this morning to get us thinking seriously as we hit Daniel with the things that are coming up. First of all, the challenge of being sure that we are, in fact, wholly following God, not just making praise statements like Nebuchadnezzar the past couple of chapters, but that we are actually following him. Second, the challenge modeled in the behavior of these three men, the actions of these three men, of knowing when and where to draw the line as we live. How do we live in a pagan culture? And thirdly, the challenge of growing into a deep faith, a resilient faith, knowing that we can trust God in the dark times, even if it means suffering in the here and now. Those three things, I think, fit together in the sense that if we can come up against one of those brick walls and somehow scramble our way over the top, we're already halfway over the next two walls. Because, for example, to know thoroughly that we are the people of God and that we follow God wholeheartedly means we're already going to be developing some kind of intuitive sense as to where that line is that we cannot cross as we live our lives in a pagan culture. And so too, either of those two things would help us endure ongoing or terminal hardship when it comes in a kind of biblical surrender to God's wisdom, the surrender to God's wisdom that's just part and parcel of genuine biblical faith. The three obstacles kind of go together. It's like they're training walls by which our overall resilience as Christians is strengthened. For all the breathless wonder we feel at the miracle itself here, and we haven't really had a chance to talk about that, but my word, miracles by definition defy possibility, and this one is certainly no exception. It's staggering. But this chapter is more about knowing whose we are and how we should therefore live in the face of suffering and hardship. And if we're prepared to wrestle with those three big things, we're going to come out more resilient in our faith on the other side of it for when our life takes unexpected turns. So do, please, wrestle with this stuff. Wrestle with these heavy things are woven into the narrative here, under the surface of the narrative. Dig in and wrestle with it. Daniel 3 is not meant to be something we just stroll comfortably past, reminding us of our childhood. It's a testing ground for our faith. There are some heavy things going on in this chapter, and it's a testing ground where which we wrestle and come out stronger in our faith. If you can wrestle with Daniel 3 and survive, then your life and faith are going to be more resilient by God's grace at work in you. We're going to have to come back and talk about Nebuchadnezzar and his journey next week. But notice that in verse 29, God has replaced the golden image. God has replaced the golden image as the focus of worship in Babylon for all people now. The new normal in Babylon is now this decree from the king. None can speak against this God because none can save like him. So let's fire up some music and worship our God.